Can the U.S. order the killing of American citizens believed to be affiliated with Al-Qaeda? Legal experts have expressed grave reservations. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A confidential Justice Department memo concludes that the U.S. government can order the killing of American citizens if they are believed to be connected with Al-Qaeda. We'll talk about the controversy surrounding that memo and also touch on other international political issues with our analysts, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University and David Skidmore of Drake University. Politics Wednesday, today in the international arena, starting after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and on this Politics Wednesday, we want to busy ourselves in the international arena of politics. Our guests, analysts to do this, Jim McCormick is the professor and chair of the Political Science Department at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Jim. Welcome back.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you with us, along with David Skidmore of Drake University, a professor of politics and international relations there, joining us by phone. Hi, David.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Good afternoon, actually.
Just into the afternoon, and we want to welcome our listeners as well to join us with questions as we comments as we talk about the drone strikes, the memo released this week about justifying the killing of American citizens believed to be affiliated with Al-Qaeda. Also, we'll be talking about Iran and the new round of nuclear talks with the United States. Some other things, U.S. Relations with France and Germany also on our docket for today. But let's start off with the drone memo, the leak of a secret Justice Department memo on using drones to kill U.S. citizens has reignited a simmering legal debate. A confidential Justice Department memo concludes that the U.S. government can order the killing of American citizens if they are believed to be, quote, senior operational leaders of Al-Qaeda or an associated force, even if there is no intelligence indicating they are engaged in a political active plot to attack the United States. The White House's press secretary, Jay Carney, held a briefing yesterday about it. Carney said that the drone strikes are conducted, in his words, in a way that is fully consistent with the Constitution and all applicable laws.
You know, we have acknowledged, the United States, that sometimes we use remotely piloted aircraft to conduct targeted strikes against specific Al-Qaeda terrorists in order to prevent attacks on the United States and to save American lives. We conduct those strikes because they are necessary to mitigate ongoing actual threats, to stop plots, prevent future attacks, and again, save American lives. These strikes are legal, they are ethical, and they are wise.
Responding to a question of the administration's review process for these issues, Carney said the procedure has been reviewed with great care by the administration internally. Now, the administration's response to questions on this memo have caused many to openly criticize the policy. One American who is quite vocal in her questions and concerns about the memo is Henna Shomsi, the director of the National Security Project at the American Civil Liberties Union. She says the argument that standards included in the document are narrow and restrictive is a false one, and that the standards are actually quite broad.
This claimed authority is one that virtually no other government in the world accepts, because they're so broad as to be virtually meaningless. And if you think about it, it's the authority to declare citizen a enemy of the state and kill that person even when they don't present a truly imminent threat, even when they are far from any battlefield, and without any kind of review by any court before or after the fact. And I think that's one of the main things about this memo that is so disturbing.
Shomsi says the document justifies the executive branch acting simultaneously as the judge, jury, and executioner, which she says is dangerous. So, River to River listeners, should the U.S. be able to order the killing of American citizens believed to be affiliated with Al-Qaeda? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let me turn to our guests to get your thoughts on this latest heating up of the legal debate over the drones. Jim McCormick, would you step in with your thoughts?
Sure. I was reading the white paper this morning, and actually there are kind of three criteria that are used in terms of making a decision of whether to attack somebody through these drones. And one is that there's an imminent threat to the U.S., that capture is not feasible, and that the operation is conducted in a manner consistent with applicable law, international law, and so on. But if you go on to read it, and this is what I think, you know, the quotation of a person you just had on was referring to, it even says in the memo that the imminent threat doesn't have to be immediate. And it goes to some lengths to say that even if there's not an immediate battlefield, if these folks have been identified in a conflict, that this is justifiable. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me immediately, it's in the very first page of this white paper of legislation that was passed by the Congress back in 2001. Because there was, immediately after 9/11, some of the callers, and Ben, you may recall, there was a joint resolution passed by Congress that really gave the president sort of carte blanche here in terms of going after individual states and groups that had been responsible for the terrorist attack of September 11th. And so this is really part of the justification. This is really a broad sweep. I mean, the Congress really gave the president a large avenue here. I'm not agreeing with it, but I'm just saying
that
is exactly the justification that is given by the administration earlier on. And they immediately say, you know, back in 1976, President Ford at the time issued an executive order saying that assassination would not be part of American foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And it immediately knocks this down on the very first page by saying that this doesn't violate the assassination ban because this is a conflict situation. This is perceived as a wartime situation really writ large here. So there's really quite a broad, I'm sorry for going on for so long, but there's really mm-hmm. a broad expanse here of authorization on the part of the president.
Your thoughts, David Skidmore of Drake.
Well, this is more than just a hypothetical issue. The United States is already engaged in this kind of behavior. In fact, the United States used a drone strike to kill a man named Anwar al-Awlaki in 2011. He was affiliated with an American citizen, affiliated with al-Qaeda. He was based in Yemen, where he put together broadcasts on the web, sort of preaching against the United States and urging people to engage in jihad. So the Office of Legal Counsel actually prepared what the media has reported to be a 50-page memo prior to that that killing, that action. And that was the legal basis on which the strike was carried out. Now, that memo not only remains classified, but the administration does not even acknowledge its existence. However, the strike against al-Awlaki, of course, became publicly known. Following that, Attorney General Eric Holder made a public statement in which he basically outlined justification for using force against American citizens under certain circumstances. Now, his public statements at the time were not nearly as elaborate as the memo that was leaked recently. The memo that was leaked just the other day was actually a kind of summary of the Office of Legal Counsel memorandum that came out developed in 2011. So this is kind of a summary that was provided to the intelligence committees in the House and the Senate. Now, what's interesting is that the intelligence committee had actually requested the original legal counsel memo, but the administration was unwilling to even provide that to the members mm-hmm. of the intelligence committee. The the document that just came out is actually not classified, but the administration did request that the committees and members and their staff not reveal it publicly. There was nevertheless a leak, and so now the administration is being forced to to respond. So a part of this has to do with the secrecy that surrounds this policy and even the whole drone campaign in general, not only from the public, but even not a willingness to even share with the Congress.
And I suppose it's no coincidence that this leaked memo made its way to, I believe, NBC News was the one that broke it at the time when the Obama counterterrorism advisor John Brennan is heading to his CIA director confirmation hearing. I believe they'll start tomorrow.
Well, you remember that he was up for CIA chief in the beginning of the first Obama administration, and his name was withdrawn because he had been a member of the he had been at the CIA during the Bush administration, and had many believed that he was somehow involved in policy relating to torture of detainees. And so that was controversial. A lot of Democrats were critical of him at the time, and so it was withdrawn. Now he's coming back, and his name is attached to another controversial policy, which is the use of drone attacks, which, of course, have been dramatically escalated in Pakistan, in Yemen, under Obama as compared with Bush administration.
David Skidmore with us, professor of politics and international relations at Drake University. Jim McCormick, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. Should the U.S. be able to order the killing of American citizens believed to be affiliated with al-Qaeda? 1-866-780-9100. Gentlemen, our Facebook page has a number of people saying no, adamantly no. John joining us from Mason City by phone. What is your answer to the question, John?
Well, good afternoon. I have a problem with Americans who turn on their own country and start to make war. I think at that point they abdicate their American citizenship and become combatants. And we as a nation have always protected ourselves from such combatants. I mean, you know, when foreigners make war and they have no rules about, you know, who they kill and how they do it, and many innocent people have died because of these foreign-born terrorists. And so when we apply some force to counter that, we're somehow criticized. So I think that although it's maybe not the best thing in the world to do, but the administration has the obligation to protect our citizens, and I think they've just chosen this as one way to do that.
John, thank you for your view from Mason City. Let's, before we go back to David and Jim, let's go to Becca in Des Moines. Your view the same or different, Becca, on this question of being able to kill American citizens believed to be affiliated with al-Qaeda?
My views are completely different. I think we're putting ourselves on a very slippery slope. One of the best parts of the American justice system is innocent until proven guilty. What if we make a mistake and we wantonly begin attacking and killing American citizens? I think that it's completely barbaric, and it makes. I'm very happy America's having this conversation, and I really hope that the Justice Department changes its practices.
So you're in agreement with critics who say that the White House is wrongly acting as judge, jury, and executioner here.
Yes, America is a democracy, and that practice is not democratic.
Thank you for your view, Becca from Des Moines. So two opposing views there. Jim, I believe you wanted to jump in again.
Well, I did wanted to say, I mean, I think that what runs through this white paper that was released, or at least leaked here, is that the administration is acting in national self-defense. And it goes, as you read it through, it goes to some pains to say, yes, there are individual liberties, and they talk about the amendments that are in dispute here would be the 4th and the 5th and the 14th Amendment. Basically, they deal with one having the security of your person, and that you should have that security of your person, and the other two amendments deal with due process here. So if you're being accused of something, you ought to have the right of due process. And the memo you know, does grapple with that, but they really come down on the side that national self-defense is really what wins out. What is most troubling to me, a number of things, but also talking about this imminent threat, because, you know, you go back to the Iraq War, and one of the real complaints about the Bush administration was that they claimed that this was a preemptive strike that they were engaged in, and critic quickly said that it was a preventive strike because you didn't know if in this case, that Saddam Hussein really had weapons of mass destruction or not, or nuclear weapons, to be more specific here. The assumption here is, particularly as you read this on, it says that it doesn't have to be an immediate. It has to be imminent, but not immediate. That's really. I don't know how you cut the difference there, and so that is really very troubling to me. I think the other thing is the language here about senior operational officers of al-Qaeda or associated force of al-Qaeda. That's pretty broad sweep.
If you show any connection with al-Qaeda, you could be included.
Apparently, well, I mean that's
the before. Al-Awlaki was killed. The administration had used the term that he was a propagandist. After he was killed, and after the legal opinion had been made, only then did they refer to him as a senior operative of Al Qaeda because they wanted to be in line with the language of their legal counsel.
Okay. This document that David referred to, the 50-page document, at least if I can put together the time frame, and I went through some of my old files here on this, it was really done in 2010. I mean, this has been around for some time.
Let's go back to our callers, John, on the line from Waterloo. John, hi. Are you troubled by this, or do you think it works legally?
I have some concerns, but I think that one thing that people are missing that these people who were the drones were attacking were not able to be arrested in those foreign countries. And if they were in this country, they would be able to, there would be a warrant for their arrest issued, and they would have a day in court. And when they're in these other places and they're threatening the country and their actions threaten people, American citizens on their own turf, they need to be brought to some sort of I don't know if it would say justice, but they need to answer.
Okay, John, thank you for that view from Waterloo. So this is really technology presenting a problem that would otherwise not be there. We have the drones to do this. Before that, what would be the operation? You could have a SWAT team swoop in and try to capture these people, but that's really what's changed here, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting because actually the New York Times spoke to a member of a U.S.-trained special operations team in Yemen, and they were basically saying, hey, we were trained to go after these guys, but we're not being called upon because the U.S. finds it easier to just use drones. And in fact, sometimes it would be better to be able to capture people and to gain intelligence information that way. But I think this is part of a larger issue. I think this memo has sparked debate in part because it has to do with the expansion of presidential power and authority in the post 9/11 period, and the memo, for instance, says that there is no possibility for judicial review either before or after the use of force against an American citizen affiliated with Al Qaeda. So the judiciary has to stay out of it, and the secrecy adds to the sense that things are being done in our name. That people may be uncomfortable with that represent a kind of unwarranted expansion of presidential power. But the other thing I wanted to say is that it's likely that the occasions in which the United States will engage in killing of Americans overseas who are involved with al-Qaeda is very rare. We've only had one case so far. What's not rare has been the use of drones against civilians in Pakistan and Yemen in ways that are also very secretive and that, by some accounts, have led to a considerable number of civilian deaths. And at least in public, governments in Pakistan, at least, have objected to. There were there was a lot of debate because the Bush administration was capturing people and then placing them in Guantanamo. Well, there have been very few captures of terrorist figures under Obama because we don't capture anymore. We simply use these drones to kill.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I got time to just there's a little study that just came out that I ran across last week by the Council on Foreign Relations on drone, because we don't have really accurate numbers on this. But this report puts together some of the estimates. But just to give you a ballpark estimate and sort of to reinforce David's point here, there have been about 3,500 people killed. And you know, and it really has varied by the year, which how many civilians. But there's been a goodly percentage. They've calculated both the total number and the percentage. And of course, most of these drone strikes have been during the first term of the Obama administration. I mean, ironically, not during the Bush administration. I mean, this has been kind of the stealth anti-terrorism strategy of the Obama administration.
Before we end this half hour, I want to finish up this topic by asking the two of you, if the president will likely confront any opposition over these strikes, are lawmakers likely to confront the president, whatever legal footing he has set down here? How will this move forward? Will there be any problems for the president, David Skidmore?
I think he's already facing calls from top people in the Congress to make public at least portions of the original memorandum that was written in, as Jim said, in 2010. And also I think John Brennan is going to face some tough questions as well. I think that the Brennan nomination is going to be used as leverage to try to get the administration to be more forthcoming.
It might even be more immediate with the Hagel nomination. I mean,
right.
There's been at least some report that they might hold up the Hagel nomination until they get a clearer understanding of what this process was. My sense is, though, that it's very tough. They can raise their voices here, the members of Congress, but in terms of stopping executive prerogative, it's very tough unless they're willing to. I don't want to use a bad metaphor here, but if they bite the bullet and do some funding cuts here.
Right. In our Constitution, the president is in charge of foreign policy, foreign actions like this, right?
Well, I always say to my class that Article 1 has more foreign policy powers than Article 2. And the Congress has been very reluctant over the years to actually use their foreign policy powers.
Yeah.
Because the evolution that has occurred has been for the president to dominate. And this makes it – that's why I say it makes it very difficult unless they really want to use the funding mechanism. And maybe they will, because we'll probably segue next half hour into talking about sequestration or something like that.
Well,
that might be one avenue.
We are coming up to the break. I think we're going to stay away from domestic politics, give it a rest this week, and keep – there's so much to talk about in the international arena with you, Jim McCormick and David Skidmore. When we come back, let's talk about something also drone-related, because tomorrow on this program I hope to be speaking with the French ambassador to the United States as well as the German ambassador to the United States. So be on this program. They're here as guests of Iowa State University. We'll tell you about that when we come back. But, of course, the U.S. using drones to support the French troops on the ground in the West African state of Mali. We'll talk about that and U.S.-German-French relations when we come back. Hope to talk about Iran and the agreement for a new round of nuclear talks, states and five other world powers. Lots to talk about in the international arena. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Politics Day with Jim McCormick and David Skidmore, back in just a few minutes. Glad you could join us over the noon hour for this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, I hope to be welcoming both the German and the French ambassadors to the United States on this program. They are visiting Iowa as guests of Iowa State University. It's Politics Wednesday, so we're giving a chance to delve into some French and German relations as far as the United States goes. Our guests, David Skidmore, professor of in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University, Jim McCormick, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. And we want to make sure, Jim, people know about the event happening on your campus. François Delattre, the ambassador of France to the U.S., Peter Amon, ambassador of Germany to the U.S., they'll be discussing 50 years of French-German friendship at 8 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union at, on the ISU campus, free and open to the public for those who want to see. They're celebrating something, Jim, called the Élysée Treaty, the 50th anniversary of us. Remind us, what is that?
That was a treaty signed between President Charles de Gaulle and German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer. And it was really an effort to, for reconciliation between France and Germany, you know, given their long history. But it was also important for another, and usually cited for this reason as well. It sort of jump-started what eventually became, you know, the expansion of the European community to what we know today as the European Union. It is seen for both of those characteristics in terms of bringing together France and Germany in a reconciliation. It called for, frankly, meetings every 3 months. I mean, if you look at the treaty itself, it calls for really close collaboration across a whole series of functional areas here, and really did cement the relationship. There's a little side story to it, the treaty as well. The French were very keen about getting this treaty. The Germans were less so because they saw it as a way for France to kind of wean Germany away from the U.S. So when the German Bundestag actually gave its approval to the treaty, it added a preamble that said that this would not affect the relationship between Germany and the United States. Mm-hmm. So there's sidelights to this as well, but it's a very, very important treaty, and it's sort of a hallmark of not only reconciliation in Europe, but also the expansion of Europe into the European Union.
And of course, at that time the treaty was signed, we were talking of West Germany.
That's right, absolutely.
And now the United Germany, but the entire Europe has been united. And it's interesting now for France and Germany, we'll undoubtedly be talking with the ambassadors tomorrow about this. There's a question of the health and future of the European Union. Can you pick up on that, David Skidmore? What's been happening with the financial woes in the European Union lately?
Well, we've all, you know, followed the European financial crisis. It's things have gotten a bit better recently, but you know, it really points to a fundamental problem, which is that the common European currency, which is shared not by all of the European Union members but by a core group, was really a political project. It was meant to continue a progress toward, you know, building a stronger political union, and a common currency was seen as symbolic of that. It was also seen as a way to help Europe act in the world, you know, in a more coordinated fashion so that they could compete with the United States and with the rising China. But the problem was that it never made sense in economic terms very much, because to have monetary union without fiscal union really doesn't work very well. So some countries, you know, are big savers, and other countries are debtors, and so have the same currency doesn't allow for, you know, economic adjustment to take place as easily. And so they've been trying to work through this crisis, one that was really predicted by Milton Friedman, among others, but without any structural changes so far. They've talked about, you know, having a real fiscal union, but that's really taking a lot of sovereignty out of the hands of individual nation states. Mm-hmm. So the crisis is moderated somewhat right now, but the structural causes are still there. Plus, you have now the British are going to have a referendum on whether to leave the European Union. The Poland, which had been on track, is now showing signs of maybe they're reluctant to, you know, to join the Eurozone, and so Europe is sort of in a bit of a still, I think, in a crisis mode. And if Europe were to unravel, and I still think that's a long shot, but if that were to happen, that would be a big problem for the United States too. We would have to refocus, I think, on Europe once again in ways that that we haven't for quite a while.
Tim McCormick, if the could the EU break up, in your opinion, and what might that look like if it did? What would we see as signs? What would be the actual things that would happen on the ground in fiscal monetary policy? Would there be a big announcement of a dissolution of the EU, or would it
happen
piecemeal?
I think that the prospects are pretty low that this would actually happen. I mean, the Germans particularly, and you might want to check with the ambassador on this, but they've ultimately, even when push came to shove, they've come to the rescue here. And I think the latest actions, I mean, that they have a European Central Bank, but it's sort of unlike the American, because, it can't print money like the American Fed can. And that has been a problem. But they've created a couple institutions now, or mechanisms, as they're called, for getting some stability, in terms of creating a pocket of money from, yes, it's voluntary from the Euro member states here, but to help out the states that are particularly, on the edge here, in terms of obviously Greece and Portugal and Ireland, Italy. I think that it's much less likely that would occur, that there would be this kind of breakup.
Any problems with the idea that the Germans are willing to bankroll any of these problem
areas? Well,
they
don't want to do too much of it because, of course, they don't want to drive up inflation, which has always been the fear of Germany here. And they want, really, frankly, more fiscal discipline. David correctly talked about some of these countries are debtors. I mean, the countries that I mentioned have really high debt to GDP ratio, not unlike the U.S., I might quickly add.
Okay.
And so those states really have to become more disciplined and therefore to become more competitive. But what these the European Central Bank, and through these mechanisms, they're trying to buy down some of these loans, at least so, that Greece doesn't have to pay 7% interest, or even higher interest rates here. How long they'll be able to do that? I mean, I suppose in that sense you could think about what is the future. But I think it's more optimistic than it was even 6 months ago, because they've also now agreed a little bit on some banking. That banks now have to have more reserve revenue, so they won't be in such dire straits with bad loans and so on. So I think they're starting to put some discipline in place.
Our political analysts this week: Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, David Skidmore of Drake University. In the international arena this hour, tackling some of the latest issues outside the United States that certainly affect the United States. And tomorrow, both the German and French ambassadors on this program. Let's circle back to the talk of drones here, too, because that does match up with our visit tomorrow by the ambassador of France to the United States, François de Lattre. The French president, François Hollande, spent part of his weekend in Mali, the West African state, where Malians thanked him for the French military fighting back against Islamist forces linked to Al-Qaeda in the northern part of that republic. His visit comes days after Malian and French forces liberated major cities in the north from Al-Qaeda-linked militants who captured that vast desert region last spring and imposed some harsh Islamic law. Karine Dufka, a senior researcher for Human Rights Watch, is urging international forces to do more, saying there has been a pattern of very serious violations on all sides since the beginning of the war.
The Islamist forces have been involved in the execution of Malian soldiers. Also, they have been using children as young as 11 or 12. On the part of the army, we found that they have been involved in some very serious violations in central Mali, in and around the garrison town of Sévéré. We documented the execution of 13 suspected Islamist collaborators in Sévéré town, and we have urged the Malian government, as well as the international forces supporting this military operation, the French, the Americans, the European Union and others, to send an unequivocal message to the Malian forces that these abuses must stop before they get any worse, and for those who have been involved to be held accountable.
France says it has 4,000 soldiers in Mali. French troops are joined by just under 4,000 African soldiers, and the number there expected to rise as this conflict continues. Jim and David, I want to give you each a chance here to join in with your thoughts on this and the U.S. involvement here. Who wants to start first? David?
Well, you know, the French had to intervene because the West African troops who were already there were so disorganized and ineffective, as well as the Mali's own military. And the government there is a weak one that has relatively little legitimacy. An elected government was overthrown in a coup d'etat by the military last March, and there's an interim government in place now. So, you know, you have weak institutions, the Islamists who took much of the north before the French intervened are apparently being fueled with weapons that they obtained as a result of all the unrest in Libya. The problem is that it's possible for the French and perhaps a follow-up UN force to take some of the population centers, but Mali is a country that is double the size of Texas, with vast desert regions. So there's plenty of opportunity for these Islamist groups to hide out and then to survive and to continue to cause unrest for quite some time. One interesting development, though, is that there is a second group of rebels called the Tuaregs, who are North African rebel group, and they initially joined forces with the Islamists against the military government, but they've been, sort of like the Sunnis in Iraq. Once they saw how the Islamists were managing, places under their control, they have quickly, decided to join the French in fighting against the Islamists. So that adds some kind of local support and legitimacy to the struggle to tamp down the Islamist rebellion.
Jim McCormick, officially no U.S. boots on the ground in Mali. What has been the extent of U.S. involvement militarily?
Well, I think the U.S. is really cheering the French here, and this really goes along with the sort of the Obama approach that, that in that famous article that Ryan Lizza wrote.
Leading from behind.
Leading from behind, right, yeah. In Libya here. And, this is a case where the French stepped up really without any kind of NATO initiative here. Obviously it's a former colony. The other dimension of this, of course, is, and what's been raised in the press, is that is this part of the Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb and so on, and what does this portend for the future? So ramping down this action in Mali will be, an important step in that region. You asked specifically, of course, what the United States has done, and this is where we come back and sort of circle back to the drones here, because, of course, this has been, apparently there have been extensive use of American drones to provide intelligence to the French operations here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But so far, we don't know that they're armed drones. The
That's
Pentagon
right, yeah.
refuses to say whether the drones are armed, and we don't. If they are armed, we're not sure that they've been employed in battle. So,
interesting that drones. Right now, we have a brief. What we can only assume, I think, is a brief window when pretty much the U.S. Drones are only used in connection with U.S. forces, but that will not be the case in future years. I wouldn't imagine.
No, it really wasn't even the case with regard to Libya either. I mean, we helped the NATO forces there. Mm-hmm. In terms of intelligence, is my understanding.
But what I mean is that every country will
develop
its own drone forces, and then there'll be counters to forces. Yeah.
Yeah, this will be another escalation, a different kind of arms race escalation here.
Okay. Let's finish up the hour talking about something on the other side of the world. Let's spin our globe down to the East China Sea. More developments in China's clash with Japan over some disputed islands in the East China Sea. Yesterday, Japan said that a Chinese military vessel trained a radar used to help direct weapons on a Japanese naval vessel near these disputed islands. The Japanese Defense Ministry also said that a Chinese frigate directed the same kind of radar at one of Japan's military helicopters in a previously undisclosed episode going back to January. David Skidmore, remind us what's going on here with these radar light-ups and why these islands are disputed.
Well, there are five islands called the Senkaku by the Japanese and the Diaoyu by the Chinese. And they're islands that China claims to have had some relationship going back 16th century. The Japanese occupied the islands and took control in 1895 and held on to them until their surrender in World War at the end of World War II. At that point, the United States, took management of these islands as well as a number of others. And in 1972, I believe, when the U.S. turned Okinawa back over to Japanese control, they also turned these islands over to Japan. China objected to that at the time and continued to object since on the grounds that the islands properly belong to China. So, there's this over the who's the sovereign power here. The reason it's become an issue recently, as I understand it, is that the islands were actually, the land itself was owned by a private family, a private Japanese family. And the mayor of Tokyo, who is a nationalist politician seeking, to burnish his nationalist credentials, I imagine, said that Tokyo was going to purchase the islands from the family, the municipality of Tokyo. So that would have been now public ownership of the islands. That incensed China. To prevent this nationalist mayor of Tokyo from taking control of the islands, the government then stepped in, the national government, and purchased the islands. One reason is because the national government has not allowed the family to develop the islands or the prefecture which they're part. So there's nobody living there. There's no facilities there, but the fear was that maybe Tokyo would try to, the politician there would do things that would be overly provocative.
So its value, these islands' value, purely strategic, not resources?
There may be oil there, but it does not appear that Japan has any interest in trying to develop oil resources in the area. There's fishing in that area, and there are fishing boats who work in the area, but they're not stationed on the islands. I think this is a matter of domestic politics in the two countries. It has to do with some very sensitive historical issues and territorial issues that really gin up a lot of national feeling in both Japan and in China.
So what is at stake for the United States? What is the U.S. involvement in this dispute?
The United States has a mutual defense treaty with Japan. So if, for instance, there were a naval clash involving China and Japan, it's conceivable Japan could invoke that treaty to involve the U.S., assuming it were to escalate out of control. One of my concerns is that I wasn't too surprised that there were these some of the initial back and forth, but it sort of continued to escalate. Even though there were some meetings recently that people thought, well, now they'll sort of both back down, but we've still had little escalations. The Chinese are flying planes over the area, sending boats into the area, and that's a little worrisome because there could be accidents, there could be miscalculation, and once missiles start flying or bullets start flying, then the pressures on politicians to not back down.
We've got just about a minute left. Maybe Jim McCormick, does this fit in with the president's talked about strategic realignment toward the Pacific?
Right, the pivot towards Asia, I mean, that the president talked about or actually announced last a year ago, January 2012. I think I was just thinking as David was really going through a very good and careful discussion of this, this really should bring to our listeners that sort of the future is going to be these disputes in both the East China Sea, but the other one that's been ongoing for some time has been the South China Sea. And it's important strategically because of the location with, say, Taiwan and Japan and so on. But it's also important because of the mineral and oil and gas resources there. But there's a third reason as well, and that is lots of international trade goes through this area. And so all of these things fit together. And I see this as sort of, and probably our listeners ought to be aware, this is kind of the new flashpoints. They've been ongoing for some time.
Okay.
But I would expect there will be a new flashpoint here in the future.
Jim McCormick, Dave Skidmore. David Skidmore, thank you for taking us outside our borders for Politics Wednesday today. It's been a pleasure being with both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
David Skidmore, professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University. Jim McCormick, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. Tomorrow on this program, both the German and French ambassadors expected. They'll be speaking tomorrow night at Iowa State University. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Caitlin Fry helped out today. Technical support from Dennis Reese and Jason Burns. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.